Welcome. You are listening to Aftersight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review, read by Nora Ami, featuring book reviews authored by critics from the New York Times. Fruit of the Dead by Rachel Lyon. Quick, what do Edith Wharton, Alfred Lord Tennyson, Geoffrey Chaucer, and the Australian experimental rock duo Dead Can Dance have in common? Answer, all have been inspired by the tale of Persephone, Demeter, and Hades. The art resulting from this inspiration has ranged from prose to poetry to haunting dark wave jams. Joining these luminaries, and still others, Ezra Pound and Dante Gabriel Rossetti among them, is Rachel Lyon, whose second novel, Fruit of the Dead, turns Persephone into a pink-haired slacker and Hades into a hybrid of Jeffrey Epstein and Richard Sackler. As with any story that has been around for thousands of years, there are many versions of the origin myth. Lyon's chapter titles produce lines from Hugh G. Evelyn White's translation of the Homeric Hymn to Demeter, which is a superb blueprint to follow. In case you're dusty on anonymous poems of the 7th century BC, the hymn goes like this. A young and gorgeous Persephone is flouncing around a meadow when she spots a narcissus flower. Leaning over to pluck the blossom, she's startled when the earth yawns open and Hades, god of the underworld, pops out like Freddy Krueger. He abducts Persephone. The girl's mother, Demeter, wanders the earth in a rage, searching for her lost daughter. I'm skipping the hymn's B and C plots, as well as its many descriptions of hairdos and bosoms. Hades, meanwhile, tricks or coaxes his abductee into eating a pomegranate seed. When Demeter reunites with her daughter after a wearying journey, Persephone admits to swallowing the magic fruit. Terrible mistake. By a mechanism not elucidated in the text, the pomegranate gaffe means that Hades gets to keep Persephone as his bride for one-third of each year, while the rest of the time she is permitted to rejoin her mother in Olympus. In Lyon's capable update, Persephone becomes Corey Ansel, a recent high school graduate who has been accepted to zero colleges and is working as a camp counselor to kill time until her next move. Demeter, the goddess of grain, becomes Emmer Ansel, an executive at an agricultural NGO. Hades is Rollo Picasso, the billionaire CEO of a pharmaceutical company that manufactures a drug similar to OxyContin. On the last night of camp, Corey smokes weed with her fellow counselors and experiences wonderment about the human brain, a corrugated ball of tender musk, synapses snapping like microscopic firecrackers, in one of Lyon's more bedazzled sentences. The philosophizing is interrupted when Rollo, who has come to fetch his son, invites Corey to dinner. In a span of minutes, the older man displays a United Nations worth of flags, all of them red. First, he asks Corey if she's a model. Then he insists on hand-feeding her a forkful of bacon. Finally, he offers her a lucrative and ill-defined job contingent upon the immediate signing of an NDA. Run, Corey, run! Corey does not run. Instead, she e-signs the NDA at the dinner table and allows herself to be spirited to a private island called Little Île des Bienheureux, Island of the Blessed, where the living is easy, the cell phone service spotty, and the Wi-Fi seemingly absent. Rollo keeps on hand a supply of his company's star product, a sustained-release painkiller with euphoric effects, and generously mixes them into cocktails for Corey to sip by the pool. When she asks if the painkiller is addictive, he shruggily tells her that people can get addicted to anything. Sex, alcohol, chocolate, video games, you name it. Corey accepts this non-response. She's a bit slow when it comes to connecting causes with effects, a bit too quick to reach for a cliché when interpreting experience. In other words, hardly a scintillating intellect. Fiction is so crammed with precocious teenagers that Corey's photorealistic ordinariness is somewhat refreshing, and it makes Rollo's pursuit of her all the slimier. Lyon doesn't gild the relationship with poetic notions about two kindred souls straining to bridge an age gap. Corey has youth and beauty. Rollo has cash and a sex drive. It's a transaction as old as time. Chapters jump between Corey and her mother, with Corey's sections written in a close third person and Emmer's in the first person. Even though the reader is given direct access, literarily speaking, to Emmer's material wrath, the character never comes to life. She's too much a cartoon of progressive hypocrisy. After 20 years helming a do-gooder organization, Emmer is shocked to discover that their proprietary strain of blight-resistant rice not only fails to grow, but seems to destroy every inch of paddy it touches. Emmer self-soothes by ruminating masochistically on the colonialist wrongheadedness of her job and listening to guided meditations. The Homeric hymn concludes with all parties committing to a tolerable sacrifice. Nobody triumphs. Everybody compromises. Persephone grows up. It is difficult, if titillating, to imagine a contemporary American edition that would go full Greek, ending with Emmer and Rollo agreeing, like Demeter and Hades, to treat the contested adolescent as a timeshare. Lyon doesn't go that route. Instead, she twists the tale just enough to needle our conceptions of coercion and desire without quite defying them. This review was written by Molly Young. She is a book critic for The Times and a contributing writer for The Times magazine. The Extinction of Irina Ray by Jennifer Croft. On Gist, Oh My Mushrooms, The Extinction of Irina Ray is incredibly strange, savvy, sly, and hard to classify. I also couldn't put it down. At length, it's nice to start a debut novel without a clue who its author is or why her pedigree should suit her so explicitly to the book she's written. But when the author is Jennifer Croft, the Booker Prize-winning translator of the Polish Nobel laureate Olga Tokarczuk, and the novel is about translators, I think you can't avoid having some expectations. I certainly had mine. For instance, this novel will foreground the vital work of translation and the various polemics associated with it. Check. This novel will be rich with translator jokes, some of which I'll get, some of which I, as a lay reader, am not meant to get. Check. Maybe, too, this novel will lampoon the process of translation alongside the translators themselves. Check. What I did not expect was that Croft's debut would frolic so joyfully, so rigorously, in the absurd, the inane, and stay there from start to finish, or that I'd end up frolicking with her. Reader, if you're looking to get your heart thrashed, this may not be the novel for you. But if you're up for a romp through a wilderness of ideas, innuendo, and ecological intrigue, who knew there even was such a thing? Stay with me. Anyone read Sartor Resartus lately? Thomas Carlyle's extremely odd novel, the title is Latin for roughly The Tailor Retailored, is narrated by an editor who's attempting to review, but really to dismantle or alternately inhabit, an even stranger book by a writer he knows and feels strongly about. The Extinction of Irina Ray reminded me immediately of Sartor in part because of its recursions. Here we have a translator, Croft, who's written a novel narrated by a translator, Emmy, a novel that is itself in translation and annotated by yet another translator, Alexis. Woe to the real-life translator who will have to take on this challenge in, say, Punjabi. It's a complicated setup, the translator retranslated, that creates for this novel multiple opportunities to pit translator against author in ways that are alternately funny and compelling, but also lay bare tensions between the original work and what a translator brings to it. After all, translation is such a fraught exercise in interpretation, transformation, fidelity, and cultural approximation. It might be the trickiest literary project there is. The novel begins with a famous Polish author gathering her 8 translators to her home on the edge of Bia Luisa, a primeval forest that has been the site of controversial logging by the Polish government. The author, Irina, convenes the summit to begin translating her latest epic, Gray Eminence. identified at first by only their languages, funny, English, French, German, Serbian, Slovenian, Spanish, Swedish, and Ukrainian, the translators know their ritual well. The entourage is powered by a kind of lust for our author and a loyalty that borders on pathology. Soon, though, precedent collapses. This time, our author is erratic, confounding, and it turns out, missing. She vanishes, tripping the novel into a mystery that cartwheels through a series of revelations, each more implausible than the last. Does anyone call the police? Nope. No one does anything a reasonable person might be expected to do. These are translators. Helpless, hapless, bumbling humans who run around the forest trucking in mythologies and fungi, fencing with plastic swords, shrieking and shouting, and periodically trying to have sex with one another. It's all very droll and increasingly bizarre as the novel proceeds. But do not be fooled. None of this craziness feels frivolous. On the contrary, the novel's staked in anxieties about climate change, extinction, and the unbalancing of nature thanks to art. That is, art in the sense of artifice, whatever we humans create that always and necessarily comes at the expense of something else. The artist is a vampire, a cannibal, a consumer of everything and everyone, especially herself. So too are the translators, who are compromised, implicated, and out for blood, less an alliance of the faithful than a maddening crowd. All of this is set against the backdrop of a wild and ancient forest, whose network of give and take, of violence and renewal, is under attack. It's no wonder everyone in this climate is dysregulated, or that what might read as farce or parody, or the horror and thriller genres of the sanctity of translation, here feels stirring, urgent, batty. The extinction of Irina Ray is mad with plot and language and gorgeous prose, and the result is a bacchanal, really, which is the opposite of extinction. Such is the irony of art, to quote the novel's epigraph, which could not be more apt. And so they forged their duality into a oneness, thereby making a forest. This novel is a forest. Go explore. This review was written by Fiona Mazel. She is the author, most recently, of A Little More Human. The Long Swim by Therese Svoboda and Roxy and Coco by Therese Svoboda. Each story in The Long Swim, the latest collection from the interdisciplinary writer Therese Svoboda, begins with a tangled paragraph of striking sentences. Characters cross paths in unpredictably baroque relationships. Narrators find themselves on the edges of the action. The wife of a beloved enough cousin, the only woman on the expedition, paddling their way to the center of the plot. Call it amped up in medias res, and take a moment to find your bearings. You have been gleefully tossed into the deep end. The book's 44 stories cover a lot of ground. New Zealand, Ottawa, Oxford, and Haiti. A sinking cemetery built on a pond, the flight of a hot air balloon, a town where a loose circus lion is reportedly on the prowl. There are hints of another world just below this one, giving the collection a destabilizing effect. A father's affair with his daughter's roommate roils beneath a friendship. On the other side of a closed door, a stepchild is either awake or lost in a drug overdose. A story of a honeymoon seems to be narrated by the couple's fetus, just a cell or two or three inside her womb, until the narrator comes into focus as their grown child, imagining the parents' relationship from memories heard secondhand. In another piece, an actor goes hard, completely catatonic and unmoving, despite his wife's best efforts to revive him. When he returns from his trance, he claims he was held captive, trapped in a place where the reception was fuzzy. There is the sense that one could reach through each of these vignettes and overturn reality. Characters struggle with the too-close rhyme of worlds hopelessly beyond reach. In the title story, On the beach at night with her family, the narrator sticks a flashlight in her mouth. It lights me, my mouth so wide and red, I'm scary. I could be a beating heart. Love, love, love. As brightly as it shines, the light in this story and others turns off quickly. Most of the plots resolve in just a few pages, leaving the suggestion of other, longer swims rippling at their margins. In Rain People, we meet high school students who serve as extras in Francis Ford Coppola's film, The Rain People. After Coppola gets a shot of a teenager in a phone booth, 13 other teens climb in. It was the era of piling. Volkswagen Bugs with dozens of kids stuffed inside, one of the pilers tells us. The booth topples, the glass breaks, and this image illustrates what's wonderful about the collection. Svoboda's prose is similarly stuffed to the brim, with invention, surprise, and the sweaty mystery of whom we get tangled up with and why. But all this excitement comes at the expense of clarity. In an overfull phone booth, is it still possible to reach the receiver, make out a voice? The exuberance of the prose often obscures meaning, leaving us with a rush of distinctive language that doesn't always connect. When the frenzy does resolve, there are lovely, lucid moments to be found, quiet observations that plumb the depths of grief, discomfort, and love. Motorcycle accidents recur throughout, and infidelities, but so do family vacations. Mental health frays, both in children and in adults. Families are thrown apart and reassembled, not always with all the pieces intact. In a story of a woman searching for her lost sister, she wonders, who says one sister and another makes two together? The titular sisters in Roxy and Coco, Svoboda's new novel, share a far stronger bond. They are modern-day harpies of mythological renown, half-woman, half-bird, fearsome creatures, vicious and unmerciful, monsters or incredible beauties, depending on whom you ask. Harpies have a bad rap about their looks, but it's strictly a projection of fear from male content providers, Svoboda writes. Roxy and Coco, blonde and brunette, are more like guardian angels in disguise. They have wings hidden under coats, fully feathered torsos, and they nosh on the occasional suet energy bar. But they're also social workers, and their very long life's work is the consideration of children who have been abandoned, neglected, or worse. The emphasis here is on guardian, not angel. Roxy has some faith in the legal system, whereas Coco, who narrates most of the book, indulges in unchecked vigilante tendencies. When a child's caretakers prove violent or exceptionally unfit, Coco has a habit of flexing her wings and snatching them up for a ride, then dropping them to their deaths from a great height. Coco's sense of justice causes her little internal moral friction, but ever since her recent zealous killing spree in Europe, the law is on her tail, and she's become, well, a bird on the lam. Svoboda's harpies have overwhelming sympathy for children. Romantic love proves more peculiar. Their biological clocks are set to 100-year cycles, but when Roxy catches feelings for her co-worker, Tim, it's 10 years too early. Premature attraction is unusual for a harpy, so Coco decides to keep a close eye on her sister, believing something has run afoul. It's not just protective sibling energy driving her paranoia. Roxy and Coco's mother died, giving birth to a too large egg conceived with a human. Falling in love too fast or with the wrong mate can be fatal. Coco is worried about her sister, but also about the dwindling number of harpies across the world. Another harpy lost brings them one wing closer to extinction. This is the central gambit of Svoboda's wry and rambunctious fable, the intersection between endangered children and an endangered species, and what it means to have protection in the first place. Or, put differently, the way people sometimes fail to see what's worth protecting, trampling whatever is precious and rare. Fear is the primary emotion humans engender in other creatures, Coco thinks. It might also be the primary emotion we engender in other humans. Roxy's ill-timed love pangs set off a plot packed with crazed oolologists, secret identities, an inept private investigator, and an avian pheromone serum. It's a frantic caper where all the machinations are tellingly in the service of profit or power, not love. I was reminded of this line from a story in The Long Swim. He's only human. How much less is only? Sabota's novel comes close to suggesting that people really are for the birds. And yet, some of the most moving moments in Roxy and Coco happen between creatures who are desperate for care. Coco meets a troubled teenager named Chris, and slowly her baseline rage melts into a subtler kind of attention and worry. In a harrowing birth scene, the physical and emotional pain is palpable, both for the mother and those who love her. The book offers brief and staggered visions of family in all its complex permutations. Here, flocks settle into wonderfully unlikely formations. It's possible that the most dangerous thing for anyone, harpy or human, is the decision to fly alone. This review was written by Hilary Leichter. She is the author of the novels Temporary and Terrace Story. Float Up, Sing Down, Stories by Laird Hunt. A small town in Indiana is the central protagonist of the lyrical, reflective stories in Float Up, Sing Down, Stories. The collection, written by Laird Hunt, whose novel Zori was a finalist for the National Book Award for Fiction in 2021, is composed of 14 linked tales, each set in the same town, which is also the same town in Zori, and each delving deep into the interiority of a single character as events large and small percolate through the community. On the surface, the stories are preoccupied with the quotidian events of daily life. Candy Wilson is making deviled eggs, but forgot to buy paprika. The teenagers Della Dorner and Sugar Henry practice kissing and reward each other for their pleasures with slices of Kraft American cheese. Neighborhood boys shoot starlings out of a tree with BBs. Della's grandfather, Hank Dunn, takes Sugar for a drive. But beneath these seemingly everyday actions pulse vivid minds that gnaw on old regrets, muse on unknown futures, and travel the length of personal and communal history. Their days seem ordinary, but they are dense with the matter of living. If the constant fullness of these internal monologues can sometimes feel slightly monotonous, it doesn't detract from the gratification of reading. The book unfolds similarly to a neighborhood cookout. You brush up against one charming moment, one charming character, and then move on to the next. In this way, Hunt's characters reveal beguiling secrets and contradictions. In one story, a slacker schemer named Champ turns out to have had a promising aptitude for ballroom dancing when he was working as a janitor. He took to it when the school emptied out, in his heavy work boots, in the half-dark with the waltz records playing. He added flourishes of his own. He liked the way his arm felt when it went rising up and up through the air. He liked it better than anything. In the process of learning what makes each character tick, what feels at first like a loosely linked collection grows revelatory, unearthing an ecology of elusive connection and meaning. This review was written by Alexandra Kleeman, who is a novelist and Guggenheim Fellow, and the author most recently of Something New Under the Sun. Third Girl from the Left by Christine Barker. Before Christine Barker was a successful dancer on Broadway, she was a little sister. Her poignant memoir depicts the vibrant New York life she shared with her older brother Laughlin and his partner, the designer Perry Ellis, as well as its collapse during the devastation and secrecy of the AIDS epidemic. Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review, read by Nora Ami.